I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. The orator, activist, scholar Cornel West, in his new book titled Black Prophetic Fire, is summoning brave voices of black leadership in our past. Frederick Douglass, Ida Wells, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King Jr. among them. He's bringing the tradition alive in our phone conversation, as he did in action this fall in the protest that got him arrested in Ferguson, Missouri.
By black prophetic fire, what I mean is that you actually do have what John Coltrane called the love supreme for the people. And when you love people, no matter who they are, you hate the fact they're being treated unjustly. You loathe the fact they're being treated unfairly. And if you don't say something, the rocks are going to cry out. So to be on fire is really to have a deep love that generates a holy anger and a righteous indignation and a moral outrage at massive unemployment, decrepit schools, wealth inequality, arbitrary police power, domestic violence against sisters, trashing of gay brothers and lesbian sisters, any hatred against Jews, Arabs, Muslims across the board. And when you look at Frederick Douglass, W.B. Du Bois, Malcolm and Martin, Ida B. Wells, and Ella Baker, those latter two need to be as known as the first four. Why? Because they were on fire. They had a deep love. They were willing to speak candidly, to act courageously, to think critically, and be willing to sacrifice their popularity for a cause of great integrity and decency.
But where are we, and where are those voices in this moment?
Yeah, we just don't have enough voices of integrity. We don't have enough voices of truth and willingness to expose the lies. We live in the age of the sellout. Everybody's for sale. Everything is for sale. All you have to do is dangle enough money and dangle enough position or dangle enough access to power in high places, and people are willing to follow through on the bid and therefore give up on the serious commitment to truth and justice. And what is wonderful about these six, but I could have added Gwendolyn Brooks and Paul Robeson and James Baldwin and Curtis Mayfield and Donny Hathaway, Nina Simone, all of these folk were folk who would never sell their souls for a mess of pottage. They'd never sell out. And of course, we know that to be the case with our brother spent the time in Boston, Brother Malcolm. You could agree or disagree with Malcolm X, but one thing you always know, that he would never sell out, that he had a commitment that was so deep, a sincerity that was so authentic. And that's what we need today, especially in the younger generation, because as you know, this book in some ways is a love letter to the younger generation. We need young leadership of not just black, but brown and yellow and red and white. Young leadership have a sense of history, connect subversive memory to personal integrity, and it generates critical thought as well as courageous witness.
Cornel West, you remind me, I think I first met you, I know I first interviewed you, sitting on Malcolm's porch steps on Dale Street in Roxbury, Massachusetts.
That's exactly right.
A blessed day.
That was beautiful to think, though, brother. You've been a force for good for a long time, because that was many, many years ago, I'm telling you.
I listen to Forces for Good. I record them, and always a pleasure to hear you. But let me say, I think you've come into your own as our kind of everywhere intellectual, and getting arrested in Ferguson, Missouri was an important step. You raised our sights, and you raised the bar of activism. You wanted us to see Birmingham in 1963, and we did. It's amazing that the South looks more and more Jim Crow, and we see it better through you. Tell us that episode, what you were doing, and why.
Well, what I wanted to do was simply to go down at a moment when the media circus was over. I know Brother Sharpton, Brother Jesse Jackson and others had gone down before, but it becomes so easily a media circus of circulating celebrities that take the attention away from the young people who actually constitute the movement, the indigenous movement, the grassroots movement. And I wanted to go down at a time in which I could stand alongside the Ashley Yateses and the Tef Poles and the Alexis Templetons and the Tory Russells and others, and be just a part of what was going on there. Now, granted, because I'm more well-known, of course, then the press is going to make more of it. But I understand myself as just one particular brother, along with the younger brothers and sisters, to bear witness to the radically unjust criminal justice system and to show the ways in which that criminal justice system is, in some sense, itself criminal. You think of Wall Street executives, not one has gone to jail, as you know. All the crimes committed on Wall Street, insider trading, market manipulation, fraudulent activities, not one Wall Street executive goes to jail, but Michael Brown's body lay for 4.5 hours with blood flowing. And Letitia gets caught with a crack back. She's off to jail. Jamal gets caught with marijuana. He's off to jail. We've had now 3 generations of young people. And by generations, I'm talking about waves of 15 years, not 33 years. 3 generations that have been wasted by this so-called war on drugs, which is very much a war on poor people, disproportionately chocolate brothers and sisters. And we know Michelle Alexander's great book, The New Jim Crow, that just lays this out. But Glenn Laurie has been saying the same thing, at Brown and Bruce Weston and so many other scholars. Louise Walquent and others have been laying this out with tremendous insight. We need to take heed.
How do we explain it, what's happened in the South and elsewhere too? But the South is where more than half of Black America lives. And broadly, fewer children can read, more Black adults have HIV. It's the shortest life expectancy group in this country. How did this happen? And then, of course, where do we go?
Well, I think since the 1980s, we have created a culture of callousness toward poor people and indifference toward working people in the name of a society dominated by big money, big banks, big corporations. So the end and aim of life is to chase dollars. And in chasing those dollars and not be cognizant of the system under which we live, a system that allows for 1% of the population to own 42% of the wealth, or 1% of the population to gain 100% of the income growth in the last 5 years. And this is after major catastrophe, major disaster that primarily was resulted in poor and working people bearing the cost. We know Wall Street was bailed out. Homeowners in Main Street had to bear the cost. That was a choice, not just of the Bush administration, Obama administration with Tim Geithner, Larry Summers, and others coming in and making sure that the major priority was to restore confidence among the very elites who had engaged in criminal activity with no serious relief or support for working people, homeowners, middle-class folk who had to bear the brunt. Middle-class, Black middle-class lost 59% of its wealth because most Black middle-class folk, their wealth resides in their homes, the homes that they lost. So this is really a story that not only needs to be told, but it needs to be much more widely available to really know the truth about the criminality in high places that got off scot-free. And the same is true with police. The connection between arbitrary corporate power and arbitrary police power. Every 28 hours, a young brother is shot by the police. How many police have actually been accountable for their murders? Hardly any at all. And that's just, you can't have any legitimate criminal justice system with those kind of practices. And more people are seeing the system itself as illegitimate. And that's a certain kind of awakening that has tremendous consequences. It could be positive in terms of serious social change. It could be negative in terms of more chaos.
But it's back in an uncanny way in politics, in the power structures. White Republicans are now playing the role that the white Democrats used to play. But the Black politicians, there was one in particular in Mississippi, Hank Sanders, who'd been at the top of the state Senate, is now way out of the power game. This sneaks up on us and suddenly, bang, we're back again.
Yeah, I know. The retreat and the regress, the Black prophetic tradition, is always tied to a universalism, but it's rooted in a particularism, which is how do you come to terms with Black humanity? If you treat Black people humanely and decently, then you got a real model of how you treat everybody humanely and decently. And if business as usual in America tends to be to fall right back into the much more xenophobic, oligarchic, patriarchal, anti-Semitic modes, though, brother. And it's very discouraging and dismaying, but we know despair is a vice. We can wrestle with despair, but we can never allow it to have the last word.
Cornel West, if the Republicans win the Congress in November, it seems to me we're entering a place that we've never been before in this country. Not only the lamest of lame duck presidencies, but a place the center cannot hold. The center can barely talk to itself. Politics, as you say, has been bought out. Jobs, work, building a future for families, for communities, for the country itself, has all been discounted or put into a second place. Yours is going to be one of those voices that people turn to, I think. So many old authorities have been outmoded or that sound irrelevant, but what are you going to tell them? What are you going to tell us?
Well, I think part of building on the legacy of Douglas and Du Bois and Martin and Malcolm and Ida and Ella is that we have a right to our righteous indignation, but it must be channeled through love and justice, not hatred and revenge. That we're up against structures of domination, but somehow we've got to muster the courage, even though it may seem like we're relatively impotent, we've got to muster the courage to always take the higher moral and spiritual ground. That we cannot respond to terrorism with simply counterterrorism. We can't respond to domination with strategies of domination. We've got to acknowledge that there are some powers, some moral and spiritual and effective powers in our souls and bodies and willingness to hit the streets and go to jail that can have effects beyond simply responding to thuggery with our own thuggery and responding to gangsters with our own gangsterism. That's at the center of the Black prophetic tradition. You hear it in the music of John Coltrane and Stevie Wonder and Nina Simone and Donny Hathaway and Marvin Gaye. You see it in the life of our own dear Michael Haines, who, of course, as you know, 12 Baptist is one of the great churches in the American Empire. So that one of the reasons why the Black prophetic tradition has been such a leaven in the American loaf is because in the face of hatred, it still talked about love. In the face of terror, it still talked about justice. And that higher moral and spiritual ground cannot be talked about enough at such a dark moment that we are experiencing and look like it's going to get darker after the election.
Cornel West, I also lean on Tony Judt, who was of the, shall we say, Eastern European, Jewish, then raised in England, came to America, branch of the Black prophetic tradition. I keep rereading his last book, Ill Fares the Land. He said, we're living in an age of pygmies, but he left three things that I don't get out of my mind as to what's wrong. A, we've lost our link to the social democratic post-war tradition that spoke of the general good. Secondly, we're worshiping the golden calf. There is a money worship in our system, in our culture, that's deeply corrosive. And third, he said, we've got a dilapidated public conversation. Our media is not telling us the truth.
Let's begin.
How do we reconstruct a public conversation that's worthy of what people know in their own lives?
Well, when you talk about the golden calf, the great Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel used to say, if you view life as a gold rush, then you end up worshiping the golden calf. And reduce the golden rule to simply he or she who has the gold ought to rule. And that's just a formula for gangsterism across the board. It's like Thrasymachus in Plato's Republic, might makes right. And somehow in the name of integrity, we got to call that into question. And this is true when it comes to corporate media. It's a market-driven media. So you end up with Fox News, mean-spirited, cold-hearted, especially toward poor and working people, right-wing propaganda. You get MSNBC, neoliberal, milquetoast, spineless, Obama, Democratic Party propaganda. No serious debate, just name-calling and finger-pointing. None of them really talk about the new Jim Crow and the prison industrial complex. None of them really talk about the drones dropping bombs on innocent people. None of them really talk about the wealth inequality with big banks. What is now 40% of all profits in the country go to big banks. Big banks don't produce one product, just big deals for folk to gain more money in the casino-like shadowy system where they make the money, out of speculation. The real economy suffers. Those are the truths that need to be told. But keep in mind, I mean, even in the political system, we got Brother Bernie Sanders, and he's a good brother. He's telling some very important truths about Wall Street. I put pressure on him in terms of our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters. Palestinian baby has exactly the same value as a precious Jewish baby, and therefore we ought to have a much more just policy when it comes to the Middle East. The same is true. Elizabeth Warren, I salute her critiques of Wall Street, but she has the same kind of blindness, though, when it comes to the Middle East and when it comes to Palestinian babies. But there are some voices inside the Democratic Party. It's just such a milquetoast party. So I have a deep disgust of both parties when it comes to issues of poor people, both here and abroad. But we shouldn't give up hope. Young folk are coming awake. Ferguson, on the one hand, look at the wonderful movement at Harvard, part of the ecological movement. So there are some signs of hope. But when you think about it, though, Brother Chris, you know, it's every moment in human history is shot through with such thick forms of social misery. And every generation has to meet the call and try to meet the challenge of breaking the cycle of domination, breaking the cycle of hatred and revenge, and interrupting it, rupturing it enough so that some kind of flickering candle of light and of love and of justice can come through. And when it does come through, you have to fight for its institutionalization. And when you institutionalize it, you have to fight that it's not turned over, that the regress doesn't set in. And that's very much, you know, what it is to be human. That's why we love Chekhov, and that's why we love Gwendolyn Brooks and Toni Morrison, the artists who remind us of the endless and perennial process of struggling to learn how to love and laugh and live with dignity and find joy in serving others before the worms get us.
One last word for Tony Judt. He writes that we have to theorize our better instincts, but he also got to act on our intuitions of impending catastrophe.
That's beautiful.
Lead us, Cornell.
Beautiful way of putting it. Well, it takes us back to the blues. You know, the blues teach us how to have compassion in the face of catastrophe. Mm. You know, and I know B.B. King said, nobody loves me but my mama. She might be jiving too. That is catastrophe, brother. But he says it with a smile. Mm. He says it with style. He says it with a little help from Lucille and the mastery of his craft. He says it with his whole heart, mind, and body, and soul. And the whole world has the blues, and we learn something from the blues and the blues people, or we lose the best of what we've been able to build over time. And we have these rich memories of those who loved us. You know, I was just at Harvard Bookstore, and I walked down memory lane, and I thought of Martin Kielsen and Preston Williams and Stanley Cavell and Hillary Putnam and John Rawls and Rodney Firth and Roderick Firth and so many of the folk who loved you. And you say to yourself, my God, if I've been loved like that, then I've got to somehow keep this love train going. And this is true in our personal lives, in terms of our wives and our companions and so forth, like dear Sister Leslie and so many others who have loved me. And how do I try to the best of my ability to build on that, regardless of what the future actually is? Those memories do keep you going. There's an intimate connection between subversive memory and personal integrity that allows us to enact a courageous witness.
Cornell West, praise God for you. That's music for the spirit, and we need to hear more of it. But it's such a joy to connect with you and to hear you again.
It's good for me to know that you are on the radio, your voice is strong as ever, that you have been able to sustain a longevity of high quality. And that is a rare thing.
Thank you, my brother.
In an age of mendacity and criminality, brother. I'm telling you, I salute you. Love you, though, brother.
Cornell West's book is Black Prophetic Fire. A whole lot more can be found at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source.